I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Parents are typically reluctant to talk to their kids about sex, and often the second most awkward or difficult conversation involves money. But kids being kids, they have lots of questions for their parents about money, which can seem very mysterious to them. For instance, are we rich? Are we poor? How much money do you make? Well, today on Radio Times, how much should your child know about the family's finances? Should allowances be tied to chores? When should they know about paying the electric bill or how to budget for the supermarket or save for that prize toy or fun things like going to the movies or a dinner out? Our guest, Ron Lieber, is personal finance columnist for The New York Times, author of a new book called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. He joins us from the studios of The New York Times. And Ron Lieber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how much did your parents talk to you about money when you were growing up?
Well, they talked a fair bit. The thing that came up for me that was the biggest issue was when my parents got divorced. Now, if any listeners have been through that, they know that it's a somewhat traumatic experience financially, in addition to emotionally. You take one household, you turn it into two. And that usually involves some sort of a loss in standard of living. It's some sort of downgrade just because it's more expensive to have two than one.
Sure.
But then my parents got then one of my parents lost their job. And our social class took a dive, basically. And we didn't recover financially until about 10 or 15 years later. And so most of the conversations around money that I remember most acutely were those. It was the process of my brother and sister and I going on financial aid at the private school that we attended in Chicago. And then it was the conversations around applying for college and the financial aid process there, which was very unfamiliar to us. And my mother in particular kind of led me by the hand, in fact, dragged me by the hand to be in the front row for all of those discussions and machinations as we learned about the process and all the things that we needed to know. And looking back on that now, I see that as an essential turning point for me.
But did they explain, or I mean, obviously it was clearly you had lost, as you said, this standard of living. Did they explain things to you, or you just kind of intuited you knew what was going on in the family?
No, they explained to me what was going on. I mean, it was obvious that there were going to be issues at school, that there was going to be less money. There were going to be less money for things like, you know, I remember it being a particular issue with basketball shoes. I was a basketball player, and the best basketball shoes, the ones that all of my teammates had, cost $100 or $110 or $120. That wasn't easy, and there were conversations around that. And there were conversations about the fact that I was going to have to work each and every summer. And those things were given. But the thing that I remember most acutely was sort of being in the room with this guy that my mother found at Northwestern University. It was an assistant dean of financial aid who on the sly was sort of taking money on the table after hours from people and offering his advice on how to
really
deal with the financial aid system. Yeah. And I just remember that front row seat and thinking, wow, there are a lot of complex systems in the grown-up world that involve money. They are basically meant to be hacked. And here we are getting the lowdown from somebody who's on the inside who's willing to help us. Isn't that cool? And it turned out that 10 years later, I grew up to be the person who helped people hack financial systems legally in the newspaper.
There you go. So you became the personal finance columnist for the New York Times. I'm interested in the title of your book, The Opposite of Spoiled. And you write about this, about talking to parents about, I guess, the thing that they feared the most. And having a spoiled child was way up there.
Sure. Yeah. So I asked about the single worst word that someone else could potentially use to describe your parenting, the thing that would be the biggest indictment of you as a parent. And when I asked myself that question, just to try and get a bead on what, you know, every parent might have in common, when I was thinking about this, the first thing that came to my mind was spoiled. And the reason why spoiled is sort of singular in this category of things that other people might call your child that are problematic is because spoiled isn't just an adjective. It's a passive verb. Spoiled by whom? Spoiled by you, by us. You know, kids aren't born that way. They're made. And so that in particular is a sort of singular indictment if somebody ever uses that word to describe our kids. So, you know, it became a sort of touchstone for me as I tried to figure out how it was we might tack against that and what the opposite of spoiled was. And it was at that point that I realized that all of these values and virtues and character traits that add up to the opposite of spoiled are things that we can actually teach and imprint using money conversations.
And I'm assuming by spoiled you mean entitled, self-centered, all those pejoratives that we associate with spoiled?
Sure. So the thing that surprised me when I kind of dug deep on this, not just on the dictionary definition, but on the sort of clinical psychological definition, was how little of it actually had anything to do with money. I ultimately came around to a four-part definition for the word spoiled, and only one quarter of it is really financial. You know, to me, the first part of spoiled is that you have no expectations. Few things are asked of you, and you can sort of more or less do as you please as a child. You don't have many responsibilities. And then the second part is that if there are any rules or restrictions, there aren't any consequences for breaking them. Part three to me is related to the helicopter parenting phenomenon, where time and attention is just lavished on kids in a way that is far from the normal amount of assistance that we ought to provide for them, so that the road is so smoothed out that they never have to worry about anything. They don't encounter any obstacles. All walls are, you know, taken down for them by their parents. Helicopter parenting, really. And it's only the last one that has to do with money, the stuff, privileges, experiences that cost a lot, for which, you know, kids are provided for, and they don't have to express, you know, any thanks or gratitude or do much to deserve them in the first place.
So when do you suggest that the parents explain to their children how much money they make?
I think every parent should tell their children how much money they make, but they should only do it when the kids are ready. And that will not happen for at least a decade after you start the money conversations. And I think it goes like this, right? You start at age 5 or 6 or 7 with a basic allowance. You do that for 3 or 4 years so they get the idea of what it's like to practice with money, to use real cash money, to watch it grow, so that they get good at math, so that they understand 2-digit numbers and 3-digit numbers and 4-digit numbers. And then you introduce them to the household finances. Maybe you start with the grocery store, because that's an everyday thing, the food that they eat. The grocery aisles are rich with questions about wants versus needs and our ethics and our standards and our principles and nutrition and environmental impact. Every stop in the grocery store is a rich vein to mine for family discussions. And then you talk to them about the rent, and you talk to them about the mortgage, and you talk to them about the bills, and you talk to them about clothing and those budgets. And again, those conversations go on for years. If they pass the insurance test without falling asleep, then another multi-year test of discretion, right? Do they keep your secrets? Do they keep their siblings' secrets, their friends' secrets? And then and only then do you sit them down and say, we want you to have this information about what we have and what we make, because it's important for you to know what it takes to have the life that we have. But you better keep it to yourself, because if you don't, not only will we be disappointed, but you'll look like a jerk if you're talking about it all over the town. And no kid wants to flunk the jerk test.
No, indeed. I'm thinking, though, that if let's say a family or a parent or a couple of parents, two parents, one of them has, say, lost their job or in the situation that you were in as a kid growing up, it seems it would be easy for a kid to worry about the family finances. And one wonders, you know, how much does a child need to know under those circumstances? You don't want them necessarily worrying unduly, but at the same time, this is the family. This is the reality that we're dealing with.
Right. I think you are absolutely right. But I believe that in the absence of information, there is more fear and anxiety and concern than there is in the presence of information that is carefully explained and mediated by the parent. So we may think that we can hide all of this important stuff from them. And maybe we can, you know, between the ages of 5 and 8. But once they start reading, all bets are off, right? They're looking at the newspaper, they're seeing the bills, they're overhearing the conversations, they have the math skills to get it. They can read and sense and feel our own anxiety about whatever situation we may be in. They will know. Even if we think they don't, they will sense it. And the anxiety that comes from the silence, from feeling like they're not part of the conversation, that this is something secret, may in fact cause more worry.
And the opposite situation, if a family is very well off and, you know, living very well, a child may say, you know, to their mom or their dad, are we rich? And rich can mean many different things, obviously, and it depends on the child. But nonetheless, when there is affluence, it seems it could raise a whole set of other issues.
Indeed. And to my mind, you know, the best single answer for any money question, but in particular that one, is why do you ask?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Because there must have been something that made them think that about themselves, or made them wonder or made them intensely curious about it, right? Maybe they once thought they were rich, but now they don't because it turns out there's people around town who do more or have more. And they're trying to straighten that all out for themselves. And, you know, it's hard. Mm. And it's worth having a longer discussion than the one that just ends with the answer yes or no, including not just why they're asking, but what the definition of that term ought to mean. Because if you think about it kind of globally or cosmically, right? I mean, most people who are lucky enough to be able to listen to public radio are in fact rich when set against the world's population. But maybe in your own community, maybe you have more than 80% of the people, but not 20% of the people. So is that rich? And maybe in your immediate community, in your school community, in your neighborhood, maybe you're just in the 50th percentile. And so for kids and parents, too, you know, it's easy to talk yourself into the middle class. But the fact of the matter is that the middle class, you know, by the sort of strictest economic definition is, you know, the median household income of roughly $60,000 a year. So if you're at 80, or you're at 100, or you're at 120, you are pretty close to upper class. And by most people's definition, that equals rich, particularly when set against the suffering that goes on halfway around the world.
Indeed. About a minute before our first break here, but do you think couples struggle to talk, or parents struggle talking to their children about money because they struggle with each other? that parents or couples have a hard time discussing money without children being present?
It's absolutely true. You know, originally I was going to have the second chapter of my book be all about how you can get your own act together first. And in fact, you have to before you begin explaining it to kids. The concern was, though, was that that would sound much more like couples therapy. So, you know, if there are two of you leading the household, you know, you absolutely need to sort of get straight on this. And some of the conversations that you may have about this before you teach it to your kids are maybe ones that you've never had before. And if you're a single parent, you need to get straight in your own head, you know, by talking to a financial advisor, a trusted friend, or just sitting down and asking yourself, okay, what is it about the way that I spend and save and give? What does that say about me? What does it say about what I stand for? What example am I setting for my child exactly? And is that the one that I want to be setting?
And that's Ron Lieber. He's personal finance columnist for the New York Times. He's got a new book. It's called The Opposite of Spoiled: Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. We are talking about money, talking to your kids about money, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. So when should you show your child your paycheck or the heating bill or the credit card statement or the dinner check? Our guest, New York Times Your Money columnist Ron Lieber, thinks it's very important to talk to your child about money early, to talk with them often, to teach them the value of money and also your values around money. That's what he writes about. That's what we're talking about. His book is called The Opposite of Spoiled. It looks like we got a lot of calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let's talk about allowances. And one of the things that you say in the book, Ron, is that you don't like to necessarily tie allowances to chores around the house. Help us understand your thinking.
Sure. So the way that I've turned my thinking on this inside out, and I would ask other parents to consider it, is to think about allowance as the teaching tool that we want it to be, that money is in fact a tool for learning when it comes to kids, as opposed to what it is for adults. And so in the same way that you would not take away a child's books or art supplies or a musical instruments if they don't do their chores or do them well or do them on time or do them without whining about it, we should not take away the money either, because the money is there to teach them. And if what you want is leverage over your kids when it comes to their chores. And by the way, they should do way more chores than most of them currently do because they are capable of a lot more than we give them credit for. If you want leverage, take away their valued privileges. Take away screen time. Take away the Wi-Fi password. Take away their ability to get to soccer practice so they won't be able to play in the game on the weekends. There is almost certainly something that your child values more than money. So take away that if the chores aren't being done in a satisfactory fashion.
Do you like the idea of the child deciding how they want to spend their allowance? And that can be a learning process. You can, you know, blow it all on bubble gum, or you could save it for that thing that you really want.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the three-jar approach, so much so that I put it on the cover of the book. I like that because it does a couple things. It's sort of a foundational sort of form of adult budgeting, right? Save, spend, give. It's what grown-ups do. But those jars are also stand-ins for some of the values that we want to imprint on them. You know, the give jar is about generosity. Save is about patience. Spend is about modesty and thrift and prudence. And so I think it's useful to ask them, okay, well, you know, if we're going to give you $3 a week or $6 a week, how do you think you should divide it among the jars? And, you know, if you like their approach and they have good reasons for it, then let them run with that. You can always change it or overrule it within reason. You know, I'm all for families having their own list of banned items. Bubble gum or candy may be on yours, or tattoos or pierced navels or push-up bras, or, you know, or you may have a not another Lego in my house rule. Those things are all up to you. No judgments here.
I'm curious. You mentioned the fact that you don't think kids do enough chores around the house anyway, separate from whether they get paid for it or not. What makes you say that, and what do you think kids should be doing around the house?
Well, I had this hunch that, you know, kids are capable of a lot more than we think they are, and in part of the way I reported that hunch out was to go hang out with a bunch of farm families, just to remind myself what happens in families where there's just an expectation that's almost unspoken that kids will work from the earliest possible age. And I hung out with this dairy farm family in Utah where the five-year-old gets up on the tractor and steers it at 5:30 in the morning so the seven-year-old and the nine-year-old can take the bottles out of the back and feed the milk to the calves. The five-year-old also has a gun that he uses to shoot at the birds to keep them from harassing the cows. Kids can do stuff. They can handle weapons without hurting one another or themselves. They can drive tractors at the age of five. There is a lot that they can do. And if we need evidence of that, just sort of in the modern world or in the urban world, in a way that can be useful for parents of all sorts, we need to look no further than all of the 8 and 10 and 12 year olds cooking these amazing feasts on MasterChef Junior, which a lot of parents are watching right now. Yeah, it's a competition show. Kids are, you know, cooking against one another and trying to impress Gordon Ramsay. And to me, the moral of that story is that our kids can and should be cooking us dinner every single night. 10-year-olds can totally do this. If you can read, you can cook. They can cook. They ought to make us dinner.
Oh, that would be great. I'm old enough to remember that I still see them. The lemonade stands is that I have often found that kids can be very entrepreneurial. You have a story about a kid recycling two kids actually recycling and making a fair amount of money. And, you know, lemonade stands show up every now and then. Kids can learn a lot about money from that.
Sure. There are things that they need. There are things that they want. They have desires for stuff that we may not want to buy them, and we shouldn't. But if they're not on the banned list, let them take a shot at it. And it turns out they can be very enterprising if the mood strikes them or if the desire strikes them. And they have all sorts of ways of, you know, earning money on their own with just a little bit of help from us. They yearn to display their competence, not just in the classroom, not just on the soccer field, not just on the piano. They want to be earners, too. They want to do what we do, and we should let them.
Ron, we have an email from Teresa. She's pushing back on something you said. She said, please tell your guests that not all people listen to NPR are rich. My salary as a public librarian is $55,000 a year before taxes. I live paycheck to paycheck. The cost of living is very high in Philadelphia. I support myself, live reasonably well, but there are many things I wish I could do, but I can't afford them. I'm not rich. I listen all the time. I'm a member. Thank you very much. I'm going back to cleaning my rat cages now. I have pets rather than children. I mean, calling someone rich or talking about people's money is a very sensitive thing.
It is, and I did not mean to be flip or cavalier with that listener or anyone else, nor did I mean to suggest that every single public radio listener is rich, although I would argue that, you know, if you have a job, you know, in the public sector, maybe you get a pension, you know, again, set against what goes on in the wider world, not wider Philadelphia or wider New Jersey or wherever mm-hmm. someone may be listening.
Like the world world, right?
Yeah, but in the world, you are really, really lucky. You are fortunate. And sometimes it can be really hard to see it that way when you live in the community that you live in. And I totally get that. And I did not mean to suggest that, you know, people in the working class or middle class ought to, you know, feel 10 times better about their situation in their current life as they did. But again, this gets to the sensitivities, right? It's
sure.
hard to have these conversations and make any kind of even remotely bold declarations about money or social class without creating uncomfortable feelings in other people. And so I don't mean to make people feel, you know, any worse or any better necessarily than they already do. I'm just trying to kind of lay the framework
yeah.
for thinking about this and for explaining it to kids, too.
Oh, and rich is a very loaded word, as mm-hmm. as we know. A comment from Elizabeth. She says that she got divorced when her kids were 7 and 14 years of age. She had to explain her planned budget to her kids. It was 6 weeks in advance. She also explained what tithing for church was. And it sounds like she's someone that might take some of or has perhaps even taken some of your advice, which is it's possible to explain to young children about one's financial situation.
I think it is. And, you know, if you're forthright about that and you do it in a way that's not scary and that actually gives them some, you know, sort of involvement in the choices, in the trade-offs that you must make on a public librarian salary or as a person who, you know, now has less money than they used to because there are two households in the larger family instead of just one, it's okay to tell kids that. They want to be involved. They want to have some power. They don't necessarily want all of the decisions to be made for them. And so, you know, maybe there are some trade-offs that you can discuss. If, you know, certain brands of food or certain brands of clothing seem off limits at this point, well, maybe the kids would actually like to keep the clothes or like to keep the food, and they would just as soon, you know, kind of cut off cable or something else that you're thinking cutting from your budget. You know, they may be willing to try certain things, and it's worth giving them a chance to do so.
I think many parents feel in competition with advertising, especially with young kids. I remember when my son was young, once he once said to me, "But Mom, it's only $99." And I remember saying to him, "What is this only business?" But, you know, kids are so susceptible to, aren't we all, but kids are so susceptible to advertising.
I think they are. Although, you know, we live in a world now where it's a lot easier to spare them at least sort of the direct commercial messages on television. But I actually worry a lot more these days about the sort of advertising they see from their friends, and not just sort of the standard who has what or who does what on the playground or in the school building. I worry about social media. I worry about Instagram in particular. I think what most kids fail to realize, and most grownups do too for that matter, is that Instagram is itself a sales tool, right?
Yes.
People are presenting the best versions of themselves and basically saying, "Hey, come check out my awesome, you know, here's my awesome life and my awesome trip and my awesome shopping expedition and my awesomely clean car and the awesome centerpiece and the turkey that I just made. And isn't it awesome? And oh, by the way, I actually want you to like it. I want you to press the thumbs up. I want you to hit the like button on Facebook." And for kids with their noses literally pressed up against the glass, this may make them feel like something or someone less.
Yeah,
lesser.
Less awesome, right?
Exactly. And even so, they're supposed to like it. And this is tough. This is a version of reality that is not, in fact, real. It is its own form of self-advertising. And, you know, I'm not big on banning stuff, but to me, this is way more pernicious than commercial television, and that parents need to take a really careful look over their older kid's shoulder if they're looking at this stuff.
And that's Ron Lieber. He's personal finance columnist for the New York Times. He's got a new book called The Opposite of Spoiled, and it's subtitled Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. That's exactly what we're talking about. We have comments coming in, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can send us a tweet as well at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments to join our conversation? We have Julie from Princeton, New Jersey, calling into Radio Times. Julie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My husband and I have talked for years about divulging our financial circumstances to our children, but we've stopped short because we've observed over the years that they just don't keep secrets. Okay. They tell their friends everything. They tell, talk to relatives. And we felt that our financial situation was maybe considered not something we want to, discuss with our relatives and such. So if we want to include them on these conversations, how do we help them to understand, not to go out and blab to everybody, how much money we have?
Julie, a quick question. How old are your kids?
They're teenagers now.
They're teenagers. Okay. So young teenagers, middle, older?
Middle teenagers.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Ron, any suggestion for Julie?
Sure. I mean, I think you need to put each and every child through a thorough, years, plural, long test of discretion. And in particular, if they are asking for this information, you need to say to them, you do not deserve it yet. And here are all of the reasons why. And you can tick off for them the ways in which that they have said things or done things or told people things that have made you uncomfortable. And then you can tell them what the standards are. Look, we are going to be watching very carefully to see how careful with you are with the private information that your friends share with you. If you are getting in trouble at school or with your friends for gossiping or saying things behind people's back, then you do not deserve to get our financial information as much as we would very much like to trust you with it because we think it's important that you have it. And the same thing is true with your siblings. If you are reading diaries of theirs, if you are tattling on them when they are doing something wrong but not doing something truly dangerous where we actually need to know right away, then that's not good. If you are sharing things about the parent or parents in the household without asking first, then you will have flunked your discretion test. And we are going to be watching. We're going to be watching for years. And we truly hope that by the time you're 16 or 17 or 18, we will be able to tell you. But the thing I try and remind parents is that, it's probably hopeless to think that the kids are not going to find this stuff out anyway. If you're truly wealthy, there's probably information about you somewhere on the internet that they can Google. They can Google your address. They get the Zillow estimate for your house. If you work for a public company and you're a top executive, your salary is out there. Same thing's true if you're a nonprofit in the federal 990 forms. If you are a state employee, that stuff is in a database. And if you're applying for financial aid, which the majority of families do nowadays when applying for college, your kids have to sign the form with all of the financial data in it. So they are almost certainly going to find out eventually. And if you don't tell them, they may snoop. They may go through your files. They may look at your tax returns. I know I did that when I was a kid.
Well, but what I hear you saying, Ron, to Julie, is that it sounds like her husband, have to have a very frank conversation, basically saying to the children, we have to be able to trust you with this information, and we don't feel that way yet.
Exactly. Look, this is a test. It's a hurdle that you have to clear. It's part of becoming a young adult. We are watching carefully. We really do actually want to give you this information, but you need to prove to us by doing all of these things and passing all of these tests, with your friends and with your siblings and with us, that you are worthy enough to receive it.
We have a comment from Marta. It looks like from her comment that she didn't give her daughter an allowance at all. I think I'm reading that correctly. Do you think children should have allowances?
I think money is a teaching tool like many other teaching tools that we provide our kids if we can possibly afford them. So to me, it stands on the same level as books and art supplies and musical instruments. It's something else that they should practice with, and they should do it over many years. So I think if we possibly can, we should give them some allowance so that they have the ability to kind of wrestle with these decisions and figuring out the difference between a want and a need and learning to make trade-offs. The problem that we have, and nobody really talks about it this way in America, because I think at our roots we're incredibly ashamed of what we've done to ourselves vis-a-vis the pricing for higher education in this country. But all of a sudden we've gotten to a situation where, if you want to go to Rutgers or you want to go to Penn State or you want to go to, any state university where there's a flagship state university, you're looking at $100,000 just for the flagship state university if you don't get any financial aid. And the people who are making these decisions about whether to spend that much and whether to go into debt to do so are teenagers. It is insane, right? Mm. But until we fix that, and it's going to be a while until we do if we manage to at all, we need to get kids ready to make these decisions. And if they have not been practicing with ever higher amounts of money, and if we're not giving them access to ever more information and ever larger numbers for the 10 or 12 years that we're having these conversations, they will not be ready to make the most important financial decision of their life, which is where to go to college, how much debt to take on, what they want to study. Again, they're teenagers, but we have to get them ready.
About a minute before a second break here, but do you have a certain age where you think a child should have a job outside the house?
I think starting maybe after eighth grade or ninth grade, to the extent that it's possible in your community, I think it's a great thing for kids to report to somebody else who is not their flesh and blood or not their legal parent, who will not give them a break, who will fire them if the work isn't being done correctly. I think it's great for kids to have to meet those standards and, you know, clear hurdles that are not of their own relatives' making.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Ron Lieber. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, and he's also the author of a new book called The Opposite of Spoiled, and it's subtitled Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And who wouldn't want to do that? We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And we're talking about how you talk to your kids about money, how much you think they are entitled to know, what kind of responsibilities that you can help them shoulder as they grow up and learn to manage their money. You can join our conversation in a number of different ways. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and chances are there's a conversation taking place on our Facebook page as well. Do stay with us. We've got much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ron Lieber about money and kids. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Ron, we have a comment from Abby. She says, what do you recommend as an appropriate amount to give as an allowance? I'm conflicted about whether or not I should give one. I can see both pros and cons. Do you have a set amount for an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old? Do you think that way?
I think when you're starting with kids for the first time, starting maybe at the age of 6 or 7, maybe you give them $1 for every year they've been on the planet, or, you know, maybe it's 50 cents for each year. The amount doesn't matter so much with the younger ones, especially ones who, you know, don't have a lot of desires. As they get older, then you have a lot more options. A couple of useful things that I've seen parents do that we intend to do with our own daughter relatively soon is that they'll say to their kids, okay, you know, you're 10 now or you're 12, and we are no longer going to buy you anything that you want unless it's your birthday or unless it's the holidays. And all of the other wants are going to be on you, including doing things with your friends or going out for lunch if you're allowed to leave campus at school. All of that is on you. And then they raise the allowance accordingly. You know, they give kids a bunch more money so that they can, you know, have a few more choices to make. And the idea there, and when I say a bunch, I don't mean, you know, $50 a week. But, you know, if it could be a raise from $5 a week to $12 a week or whatever the number is that allows them to get some of the things that they want, but not so much money that they don't have to make a ton of really difficult adult-like trade-offs with their money. So that's the magic number, whatever that is for you. Another thing you can do is turn over the entire year's budget for clothing to your kids. You know, you sit down, you map it out very carefully, you explain why it is that, you know, your budget for underwear is $6, but your budget for per brief or whatever, but why your budget for outerwear may be $175, and you explain that to them, and then you just give them all of the money and let them make their own decisions. And if they want the Victoria's Secret underwear, that's fine, but they're going to have to go to the Goodwill store for their winter coat.
I mean, I think it's a really clever idea, but I'm also thinking that there are some parents where they would see that as giving up control, that they want to be able to control what their kids spend their money on. And if you're letting them decide, you're losing control.
I would ask those parents to think about the long game here. And when you're thinking about control and the control that you ultimately want to exert or exercise, to me, the end game is what we want to control is whether we have succeeded in our tasks in the adult-making business here. And the end game there is to have kids who are financially responsible and hopefully financially independent by the time they're 22 or 23 or 24. So far better to give up some control in the interim. Hand over a lump sum of money, let them fail spectacularly and see what kind of mistakes they make. It's often quite entertaining to watch. But let them blow it when they're 12 or 14 or 16, when we can watch and we can help them pick up the pieces and we can give them opportunities to earn more money if they need it. Far better for that to happen now than to have to exert or re-exert control when they're 24 or 26 and they need to move back in with us because they have utterly destroyed their credit because we didn't give them enough opportunities to have control over money when they were teenagers.
And do you give a teenager a credit card?
I think it's perfectly fine to give a kid a credit card that's attached to your account for emergencies or explicit and specific uses and you know, permission-based events only. You know, kids will define emergency down in all sorts of ways if you don't put pretty strict boundaries on it. But again, you know, good for them to make those mistakes when they are with you and not to make those mistakes later when all sorts of bad actors will be trying to give them more credit than they need or deserve or should probably use when they're in their 20s.
Is there an income divide when it comes to how much boys and girls get for allowance? Are the parents sort of mimic what we see in the economy as a whole?
I'm glad you brought that up because as a father of a daughter, this is something that I think about a lot. And in fact, there is a lot of survey research that shows that parents don't talk to girls as much about money as they do boys. And when they do talk to girls, the only thing they talk to them more about than they do with boys is philanthropy.
Really? Wow.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, we may think that we're all equitable and, you know, we're keeping this all in our minds, but something is going terribly awry. And the result of this is that girls earn less as teenagers than boys do by about 30%. And their expectations of their starting salary as adults and their mid-tier salary as adults is also about one-third less than what the boys expect. Mm-hmm. This drives me bananas, and we need to make it stop. So if your girls are not asking you about money, they're not asking you about the stock market, it does not mean you're off the hook. In fact, it means that you need to redouble your efforts with them specifically.
And how old is your daughter? Just curious.
My daughter is 9.
Is 9. Okay. So you've got some adventures ahead, shall I say.
Indeed.
Let me get Maria from Central Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say what I did around the giving part that I found really helped my kids to understand, you know, not just what we have versus their friends have or what their friends are able to buy, but also like bigger political discussions. I mean, my kids are only 10 and 12, but we've actually had really great class discussions. Which political party supports giving more money to people who have less money, all those sorts of things. And one of the ways we started that was that when our kids have a party, they have enough. So we ask them to choose there's lots of great charities, but it's particularly ones that give to other children. So there's a group called One Simple Wish, and they grant wishes for kids in foster care who have no money to get to take a piano lesson or, you know, get to do a sport after school or those sorts of things. So we had them pick one of those gifts, and then we had everybody contribute to grant that wish for that child so that they could see it in the context of, you know, what we're able to have, what other people don't have, and then also start to think about the bigger picture.
That's a great story, Maria. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ron, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I love that. So first birthday parties and then political parties, two rich veins to mine there.
Exactly.
When it comes to birthday parties, I think that's great. You know, some parents worry that If they sort of lay the rules down in that way, it may look like they're judging other families in the community who still let their kids get presents. And so that they worry about, you know, being a little judgy. One way to kind of split the difference on this, we've done this once with our daughter. We used a service in Canada called Echo Age, where the people who come to the party just take whatever they would spend. And, you know, nobody really cares what it is on the gift. And that all gets thrown into a pile. And then the kid takes half the money and gives it away to a single cause of their choosing. And then they take the other half and they buy themselves one big special thing instead of getting 10 or 15 random trinkets that will be long forgotten in 6 months. So, you know, that's a way to split the party thing down the middle. As far as political parties go, I like that she brought that up because, you know, you can think about giving with kids in falling into, you know, roughly kind of three different segments as they get older. You know, when they start, you can let them give to whoever or whatever they want out of the give jar in their allowance. Then maybe starting at the age of 9 or 10, you tell them, okay, no more animal charities, which is what kids often gravitate to. You need to reckon with and attempt to alleviate real human suffering. And then maybe by the time they're 12 or 13, you can explain to them, you know, you may want to give to the homeless shelter or the food bank, and that's great. It's a valuable thing to do. But there are also organizations that we can give to or to political candidates who have their own ideas about changing the rules and changing some of the structural conditions that cause people to need food and need beds in the first place. And so we can give money that way too in a way to try and change things in the long term and not just change things right now on the ground. And so I think that's a useful way to frame giving for kids. So I love the way that she's thinking.
Maria, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Ron, I want to read an email from Dar saying, my 15-year-old stepson has developed a terrible and disturbing habit of stealing large amounts of money from his family members. He grew up working for his dad, legitimately getting paychecks and also getting an allowance for house chores. What are your thoughts on why kids steal? And I'm talking about hundreds of dollars here. And, you know, maybe it's time to see a therapist. But I'd be curious, Ron, what your thoughts are.
Well, I'd want to talk to the kid about why the kid is stealing and, you know, to talk about whatever feelings are causing him to want to do this. Is it, you know, anger at the parents for not paying him enough? Is it, you know, feelings of envy because there are other kids around him who have more? Is it because the parents are strict about what they'll buy for him, but they're not explaining the reasoning behind their strictness well? Look, you know, I mean, criminal behavior, and that's what this is never okay. But I'd want to know exactly what's driving it. I'd want to really know what the feelings are behind this money behavior and this money swipery so that I could, you know, try and do as good of a job as I can of making whatever those feelings are go away or redirecting them in the very least towards an explanation that might cause the child to feel differently.
Dar, thanks for the email. We also have a Facebook comment from Laura saying that in her house growing up, money was always a taboo. And I mean, in many ways, you know, children can't necessarily change the conversation in the house about money. But for those families where just money does not exist, we do not talk about money. What do you suggest people, or perhaps what do you suggest children do?
Well, I would challenge the parents to think about it this way. If your response to money questions is that it's none of the kids' business, I mean, first of all, it's a lie. It's not actually true, because if you are a member of the household, its business is your business, and certainly the revenues and the expenses affect you directly, right? So you know, we shouldn't lie to our kids. And if that's not convincing enough for you, then think about it this way. When you shut them down on matters of great import, the moral of that story, the moral of that conversation to the kid is that parents are no longer the primary source of all of the world's known and important information. And what they will take away from that is that when they have things that are pressing, that are complicated, that evoke feelings, that are messy, the parents are the wrong place to go for the answers. And is that really what you want them to take away? Because if you treat them that way when it comes to money, they may well make the leap that, you know, when they have complex questions about sex or drugs or mental health or really anything important and controversial, then you're not the ones they should go to for that either. And I don't think anybody wants to end up being that parent where the kid simply no longer trusts that they will be able to get the most important information that they need from the mom or the dad or the moms of the dads.
We have an email from Joni. She says, when our kids were young teens, we wanted to encourage them to save a percentage of what they earned at part-time jobs. We set up a 401k like savings match. If they deposited a dollar to a savings account, we matched it. They had to leave it in for a year to be vested like the real world or lose our contribution. What do you think of that idea, Ron?
Incentives are awesome. Yay, incentives, right? Yeah, look, I mean, this is what employers do out there in the world. They have lots of reasons for doing so. I don't see any problem with providing your own incentives, you know, within your own household. And it doesn't have to be just for savings. Some parents will offer incentives for charity, or they'll say to the kid, okay, you've really saved a lot here. You don't seem to have a lot of uses for it right now. You know, you can keep the money there, but if you move a quarter of your saving money to the charity jar, you know, we'll match that 3-to-1 and it'll give you a lot more power to do a lot more good in the world. So, you know, you can use the incentives in all sorts of ways.
Let me see what Matt from West Philadelphia has to say. Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
You're welcome.
So there's like, I think there's maybe some pressure from on schools to teach students and kids about financial literacy, like about checking credit score, investing, how to do taxes. I just wanted to see what the presenter had to talk about that today.
Sure. Yeah, Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Ron, the idea that, schools should be teaching financial literacy.
I would never in a million years want to be the person who is attempting to heap more responsibility on public school teachers in particular at a time when so much is already being asked of them. That said, you know, I do consider financial literacy to be essential. You know, the research is decidedly mixed on the kind of impact that it has over the long term. But here's one thing that doesn't go on that I think absolutely should. As we were discussing earlier, right, these kids are about to make the biggest financial decision in their lives, you know, at the age of 16 or 17 or 18 about college. And one thing that basically doesn't go on is that none of these kids are put through an intensive 12-week mini course about the financial aid system, how student loans work, what the FAFSA is for, you know, the impact of taking on too much debt, the impact of going to school, taking on debt, and then not finishing, which is the worst of all situations. So that is something that the schools can or should do more of. But again, if you believe, as I do, that there's a direct connection between money and values, then that's the kind of thing that I think you do not want to outsource to teachers or religious leaders or anybody else. You want to be teaching that stuff yourself in the home if you possibly can.
We're almost out of time here, but how much as a financial columnist do you feel like you have to be a therapist as well?
Oh, I think 100%. I mean, look, there's a direct connection between money and behavior and emotions and feelings. And when you throw parenting into the mix, you know, these kids that are our flesh and blood or who we've taken in and made our own, you know, it's high stakes stuff. We want them to get the very best of us, but not our worst traits. And, you know, it invokes all sorts of really intense emotions. So by all means, I mean, the sort of, you know, the mental health aspect of this is absolutely essential.
Ron Lieber, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Personal finance columnist for the New York Times, author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program, how to sign up for the newsletter, and how to join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. We also had assistance today from Joyce Lieberman. Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.